This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents 1Q84, written by Haruki Murakami, narrated by Allison Hiroto, Mark Vitor, and Mark Boyette.
It's a Barnum and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. It's only a paper moon. Billy Rose and E.Y. Yip Harburg. Book 1. April to June.
Chapter 1. Our Mamet. Don't let appearances fool you. The taxi's radio was tuned to a classical FM broadcast. Janacek's Sinfonietta, probably not the ideal music to hear in a taxi caught in traffic. The middle-aged driver didn't seem to be listening very closely either. With his mouth clamped shut, he stared straight ahead at the endless line of cars stretching out on the elevated expressway, like a veteran fisherman standing in the bow of his boat, reading the ominous confluence of two currents. Almama settled into the broad back seat, closed her eyes, and listened to the music. How many people could recognize Janacek's Sinfonietta after hearing just the first few bars? Probably somewhere between very few and almost none. But for some reason, Almama was one of the few who could. Janacek composed his little symphony in 1926. He originally wrote the opening as a fanfare for a gymnastics festival. Almama imagined 1926 Czechoslovakia. The First World War had ended, and the country was freed from the long rule of the Habsburg dynasty. As they enjoyed the peaceful respite visiting Central Europe, people drank Pilsner beer in cafes and manufactured handsome light machine guns. 2 years earlier, in utter obscurity, Franz Kafka had left the world behind. Soon Hitler would come out of nowhere and gobble up this beautiful little country in the blink of an eye. But at the time, no one knew what hardships lay in store for them. This may be the most important proposition revealed by history. At the time, no one knew what was coming. Listening to Janacek's music, Almama imagined the carefree winds sweeping across the plains of Bohemia and thought about the vicissitudes of history. In 1926, Japan's Taisho Emperor died, and the era name was changed to Showa. It was the beginning of a terrible, dark time in this country, too. The short interlude of modernism and democracy was ending, giving way to fascism. Almame loved history as much as she loved sports. She rarely read fiction, but history books could keep her occupied for hours. What she liked about history was the way all its facts were linked with particular dates and places. She did not find it especially difficult to remember historical dates. Even if she did not learn them by rote memorization, once she grasped the relationship of an event to its time and to the events preceding and following it, the date would come to her automatically. In both middle school and high school, she had always gotten the top grade on history exams. It puzzled her to hear someone say he had trouble learning dates. How could something so simple be a problem for anyone? Almame was her real name. Her grandfather on her father's side came from some little mountain town or village in Fukushima Prefecture, where there were supposedly a number of people who bore the name, written with exactly the same characters as the word for green peas, and pronounced with the same four syllables, A-O-Mamme. She had never been to the place, however. Her father had cut his ties with his family before her birth, just as her mother had done with her own family, so she had never met any of her grandparents. She didn't travel much, but on those rare occasions when she stayed in an unfamiliar city or town, she would always open the hotel's phone book to see if there were any Aomames in the area. She had never found a single one, and whenever she tried and failed, she felt like a lonely castaway on the open sea. Telling people her name was always a bother. As soon as the name left her lips, the other person looked puzzled or confused. Miss Aomame? Yes, just like green peas. Employers required her to have business cards printed, which only made things worse. People would stare at the card as if she had thrust a letter at them bearing bad news. When she announced her name on the telephone, she would often hear suppressed laughter. In waiting rooms, at the doctor's, or at public offices, people would look up at the sound of her name, curious to see what someone called green peas could look like. Some people would get the name of the plant wrong and call her edamame or soramame, whereupon she would gently correct them. No, I'm not soybeans or fava beans, just green peas. Pretty close, though. Aomame. How many times in her 30 years has she heard the same remarks, the same feeble jokes about her name? My life might have been totally different if I hadn't been born with this name. If I had had an ordinary name like Sato, or Tanaka, or Suzuki, I could have lived a slightly more relaxed life, or looked at people with somewhat more forgiving eyes. Perhaps. Eyes closed, Aomame listened to the music, allowing the lovely unison of the brasses to sink into her brain. Just then it occurred to her that the sound quality was too good for a radio in a taxicab. Despite the rather low volume at which it was playing, the sound had true depth, and the overtones were clearly audible. She opened her eyes and leaned forward to study the dashboard stereo. The jet-black device shone with a proud gloss. She couldn't make out its brand name, but it was obviously high-end, with lots of knobs and switches, the green numerals of the station read out clear against the black panel. This was not the kind of stereo you expected to see in an ordinary fleet cab. She looked around at the cab's interior. She had been too absorbed in her own thoughts to notice until now, but this was no ordinary taxi. The high quality of the trim was evident, and the seat was especially comfortable. Above all, it was quiet. The car probably had extra sound insulation to keep noise out, like a soundproofed music studio. The driver probably owned his own cab. Many such owner-drivers would spare no expense on the upkeep of their automobiles. Moving only her eyes, Aomame searched for the driver's registration card without success. This did not seem to be an illegal unlicensed cab, though. It had a standard taximeter, which was ticking off the proper fare, 2,150 yen so far. Still, the registration card showing the driver's name was nowhere to be found. "What a nice car," Aomame said, speaking to the driver's back. "So quiet. What kind is it?" "Toyota Crown Royal Saloon," the driver replied succinctly. "The music sounds great in here." "It's a very quiet car. That's one reason I chose it. Toyota has some of the best sound insulating technology in the world." Aomame nodded and leaned back in her seat. There was something about the driver's way of speaking that bothered her, as though he were leaving something important unsaid. For example, and this is just one example, his remark on Toyota's impeccable sound insulation might be taken to mean that some other Toyota feature was less than impeccable. And each time he finished a sentence, there was a tiny but meaningful lump of silence left behind. This lump floated there, enclosed in the car's restricted space, like an imaginary miniature cloud, giving Almame a strangely unsettled feeling. "It certainly is a quiet car," Almame declared, as if to sweep the little cloud away. "And the stereo looks especially fine." "Decisiveness was key when I bought it," the driver said, like a retired staff officer explaining a past military success. "I have to spend so much time in here. I want the best sound available. And..." Almame waited for what was to follow, but nothing followed. She closed her eyes again and concentrated on the music. She knew nothing about Janáček as a person, but she was quite sure that he never imagined that in 1984 someone would be listening to his composition in a hushed Toyota Crown Royal saloon on the gridlocked elevated Metropolitan Expressway in Tokyo. Why, though, Almame wondered, had she instantly recognized the piece to be Janáček's Sinfonietta? And how did she know it had been composed in 1926? She was not a classical music fan, and she had no personal recollections involving Janáček. Yet the moment she heard the opening bars, all her knowledge of the piece came to her by reflex, like a flock of birds swooping through an open window. The music gave her an odd, wrenching kind of feeling. There was no pain or unpleasantness involved, just a sensation that all the elements of her body were being physically wrung out. Almame had no idea what was going on. Could Sinfonietta actually be giving me this weird feeling? "Janáček," Almame said half-consciously, though after the word emerged from her lips she wanted to take it back. "What's that, ma'am?" "Janáček, the man who wrote this music."
"Never heard of him."
"Czech composer."
"Well, well," the driver said, seemingly impressed.
"Do you own this cab?" Almame asked, hoping to change the subject.
"I do," the driver answered. After a brief pause, he added, "It's all mine. My second one."
"Very comfortable seats."
"Thank you, ma'am."
Turning his head slightly in her direction, he asked, "By the way, are you in a hurry?"
"I have to meet someone in Shibuya. That's why I asked you to take the expressway."
"What time is your meeting?"
4:30, Almame said.
"Well, it's already 3:45. You'll never make it."
"Is the backup that bad?"
"Looks like a major accident up ahead. This is no ordinary traffic jam. We've hardly moved for quite a while."
She wondered why the driver was not listening to traffic reports. The expressway had been brought to a standstill. He should be listening to updates on the taxi driver's special radio station.
"You can tell it's an accident without hearing a traffic report?" Almame asked.
"You can't trust them," he said with a hollow ring to his voice. "They're half lies. The Expressway Corporation only releases reports that suit its agenda. If you really want to know what's happening here and now, you've got to use your own eyes and your own judgment."
"And your judgment tells you that we'll be stuck here?"
"For quite a while," the driver said with a nod. "I can guarantee you that. When it backs up solid like this, the expressway is sheer hell."
"Is your meeting an important one?"
Almame gave it some thought.
"Yes, very. I have to see a client."
"That's a shame. You're probably not going to make it."
The driver shook his head a few times, as if trying to ease a stiff neck. The wrinkles on the back of his neck moved like some kind of ancient creature. Half-consciously watching the movement, Almame found herself thinking of the sharp object in the bottom of her shoulder bag. A touch of sweat came to her palms.
"What do you think I should do?" she asked.
There's nothing you can do up here on the expressway. Not until we get to the next exit. If we were down on the city streets, you could just step out of the cab and take the subway.
What is the next exit?
Ikejiri. We might not get there before the sun goes down, though.
Before the sun goes down? Ah, Mama imagined herself locked in this cab until sunset.
The Yanacek was still playing. Muted strings came to the foreground as if to soothe her heightened anxiety. That earlier wrenching sensation had largely subsided. What could that have been?
Almame had caught the cab near Kinuta and told the driver to take the elevated expressway from Yoga. The flow of traffic had been smooth at first, but suddenly backed up just before Sangenjaya, after which they had hardly moved. The outbound lanes were moving fine. Only the side headed toward downtown Tokyo was tragically jammed. Inbound expressway number 3 would not normally back up at 3 in the afternoon, which was why Aomame had directed the driver to take it.
"Time charges don't add up on the expressway," the driver said, speaking toward his rearview mirror. "So don't let the fare worry you. I suppose you need to get to your meeting, though."
"Yes, of course. But there's nothing I can do about it, is there?"
He glanced at her in the mirror. He was wearing pale sunglasses. The way the light was shining in, Aomame could not make out his expression.
"Well, in fact, there might be a way. You could take the subway to Shibuya from here, but you'd have to do something a little extreme."
"Something extreme?"
"It's not something I can openly advise you to do."
Aomame said nothing. She waited for more with narrowed eyes.
"Look over there. See that turnout just ahead?" he asked, pointing.
"See? Near that Esso sign." Aomame strained to see through the windshield until she focused on a space to the left of the two-lane roadway where broken-down cars could pull off. The elevated roadway had no shoulder, but instead had emergency turnouts at regular intervals. Aomame saw that the turnout was outfitted with a yellow emergency phone box for contacting the Metropolitan Expressway Public Corporation office. The turnout itself was empty at the moment. On top of a building beyond the oncoming lanes, there was a big billboard advertising Esso gasoline, with a smiling tiger holding a gas hose.
"To tell you the truth, there's a stairway leading from the turnout down to street level. It's for drivers who have to abandon their cars in a fire or earthquake and climb down to the street. Usually only maintenance workers use it. If you were to climb down that stairway, you'd be near a Tokyo Line station. From there, it's nothing to Shibuya."
"I had no idea these metropolitan expressways had emergency stairs," Aomame said.
"Not many people do."
"But wouldn't I get in trouble using it without permission when there's no real emergency?" The driver paused a moment. Then he said,
"I wonder. I don't know all the rules of the corporation, but you wouldn't be hurting anybody. They'd probably look the other way, don't you think? Anyway, they don't have people watching every exit. The Metropolitan Expressway Public Corporation is famous for having a huge staff, but nobody really doing any work."
"What kind of stairway is it?"
Kind of like a fire escape. You know, like the ones you see on the backs of old buildings. It's not especially dangerous or anything. It's maybe 3 stories high, and you just climb down. There's a barrier at the opening, but it's not very high. Anybody who wanted to could get over it easily."
"Have you ever used one of these stairways?" Instead of replying, the driver directed a faint smile toward his rearview mirror. A smile that could be read any number of ways.
"It's strictly up to you,"
he said, tapping lightly on the steering wheel in time to the music. If you just want to sit here and relax and enjoy the music, I'm fine with that. We might as well resign ourselves to the fact that we're not going anywhere soon. All I'm saying is that there are emergency measures you can take if you have urgent business.
Amame frowned and glanced at her watch. She looked up and studied the surrounding cars. On the right was the black Mitsubishi Pajero wagon, with a thin layer of white dust. A bored-looking young man in the front passenger seat was smoking a cigarette with his window open. He had long hair, a tanned face, and wore a dark red windbreaker. The car's luggage compartment was filled with a number of worn surfboards. In front of him was a gray Saab 900, its dark-tinted windows closed tight, preventing any glimpse of who might be inside. The body was so immaculately polished, you could probably see your face in it. The car ahead was a red Suzuki Alto, with a Nerima Ward license plate and a dented bumper. A young mother sat gripping the wheel. Her small child was standing on the seat next to her, moving back and forth to dispel its boredom. The mother's annoyance showed on her face as she cautioned the child to keep still. Almame could see her mouth moving. The scene was unchanged from 10 minutes earlier. In those 10 minutes, the car had probably advanced less than 10 yards. Almame thought hard, arranging everything in order of priority. She needed hardly any time to reach a conclusion. As if to coincide with this, the final movement of the Janacek was just beginning. She pulled her small Ray-Ban sunglasses partway out of her shoulder bag and took 3,000 yen bills from her wallet. Handing the bills to the driver, she said, "I'll get out here. I really can't be late for this appointment." The driver nodded and took the money. "Would you like a receipt?"
"No need, and keep the change."
"Thanks very much," he said. "Be careful, it looks windy out there. Don't slip."
"I'll be careful," Almame said.
"And also," the driver said, facing the mirror, "please remember, things are not what they seem."
"Things are not what they seem," Almame repeated mentally.
"What do you mean by that?" she asked with knitted brows. The driver chose his words carefully. "It's just that you're about to do something out of the ordinary. Am I right? People do not ordinarily climb down the emergency stairs of the Metropolitan Expressway in the middle of the day, especially women."
"I suppose you're right."
"Right. And after you do something like that, the everyday look of things might seem to change a little. Things may look different to you than they did before. I've had that experience myself. But don't let appearances fool you. There's always only one reality."
Almame thought about what he was saying, and in the course of her thinking, the Janacek ended and the audience broke into immediate applause. This was obviously a live recording. The applause was long and enthusiastic. There were even occasional calls of bravo. She imagined the smiling conductor bowing repeatedly to the standing audience. He would then raise his head, raise his arms, shake hands with the concertmaster, turn away from the audience, raise his arms again in praise of the orchestra, face front, and take another deep bow. As she listened to the long recorded applause, it sounded less like applause and more like an endless Martian sandstorm. "There is always, as I said, only one reality," the driver repeated slowly, as if underlining an important passage in a book.
"Of course," Almame said. He was right. A physical object could only be in one place at a time. Einstein proved that. Reality was utterly cool-headed and utterly lonely. Almame pointed toward the car stereo.
Great sound. The driver nodded. What was the name of that composer again?
Janáček.
Janáček, the driver repeated, as if committing an important password to memory. Then he pulled the lever that opened the passenger door. Be careful, he said. I hope you get to your appointment on time. Almamis stepped out of the cab, gripping the strap of her large leather shoulder bag. The applause was still going. She started walking carefully along the left edge of the elevated road toward the emergency turnout some 10 meters ahead. Each time a large truck roared by on the opposite side, she felt the surface of the road shake, or rather undulate, through her high heels, as if she were walking on the deck of an aircraft carrier on a stormy sea. The little girl in the front seat of the red Suzuki Alto stuck her head out of her window and stared, open-mouthed, at Almame passing by. Then she turned to her mother and asked, Mommy, what is that lady doing? Where is she going? I want to get out and walk too. Please, Mommy, please. The mother responded to her cries in silence, shaking her head and shooting an accusatory glance at Almame. The girl's loud pleading and the mother's glance were the only responses to her that Almame noticed. The other drivers just sat at the wheel, smoking and watching her make her way with determined steps between the cars and the sidewall. They knit their brows and squinted, as if looking at a too bright object, but seemed to have temporarily suspended all judgment. For someone to be walking on the Metropolitan Expressway was by no means an everyday event, with or without the usual flow of traffic. So it took them some time to process the sight as an actual occurrence, all the more so because the walker was a young woman in high heels and a miniskirt. Almame pulled in her chin, kept her gaze fixed straight ahead, her back straight, and her pace steady. Her chestnut-colored Charles Jourdan heels clicked against the road surface, and the skirts of her coat waved in the breeze. April had begun. But there was still a chill in the air and a hint of roughness to come. Almame wore a beige spring coat over her green light wool Junko Shimada suit. A black leather bag hung over her shoulder, and her shoulder-length hair was impeccably trimmed and shaped. She wore no accessories of any kind. 5'6" tall, she carried not an ounce of excess fat. Every muscle in her body was well-toned, but her coat kept that fact hidden. A detailed examination of her face from the front would reveal that the size and shape of her ears were significantly different, the left one much bigger and malformed. No one ever noticed this, however, because her hair nearly always covered her ears. Her lips formed a tight, straight line, suggesting that she was not easily approachable. Also contributing to this impression were her small, narrow nose, somewhat protruding cheekbones, broad forehead, and long, straight eyebrows. All of these were arranged to sit in a pleasing oval shape, however, and while tastes differ, few would object to calling her a beautiful woman. The one problem with her face was its extreme paucity of expression. Her firmly closed lips only formed a smile when absolutely necessary. Her eyes had the cool, vigilant stare of a superior deck officer. Thanks to these features, no one ever had a vivid impression of her face. She attracted attention not so much because of the qualities of her features, but rather because of the naturalness and grace with which her expression moved. In that sense, Almame resembled an insect skilled at biological mimicry. What she most wanted was to blend in with her background by changing color and shape, to remain inconspicuous and not easily remembered. This was how she had protected herself since childhood. Whenever something caused her to frown or grimace, however, her features underwent dramatic changes. The muscles of her face tightened, pulling in several directions at once and emphasizing the lack of symmetry in the overall structure. Deep wrinkles formed in her skin. Her eyes suddenly drew inward. Her nose and mouth became violently distorted. Her jaw twisted to the side, and her lips curled back, exposing Almama's large white teeth. Instantly, she became a wholly different person, as if a cord had broken, dropping the mask that normally covered her face. The shocking transformation terrified anyone who saw it, so she was careful never to frown in the presence of a stranger. She would contort her face only when she was alone, or when she was threatening a man who displeased her. Reaching the turnout, Almama stopped and looked around. It took only a moment for her to find the emergency stairway. As the driver had said, there was a metal barrier across the entrance. It was a little more than waist high, and it was locked. Stepping over it in a tight miniskirt could be a slight problem, but only if she cared about being seen. Without hesitating, she slipped her high heels off and shoved them into her shoulder bag. She would probably ruin her stockings by walking in bare feet, but she could easily buy another pair. People stared at her in silence as she removed her shoes and coat. From the open window of the black Toyota Celica parked next to the turnout, Michael Jackson's high-pitched voice provided her with background music. Billie Jean was playing. She felt as if she were performing a striptease. So what? Let them look all they want. They must be bored waiting for the traffic jam to end. Sorry, though, folks. This is all I'll be taking off today. Almama slung the bag across her chest to keep it from falling. Some distance away, she could see the brand new black Toyota Crown Royal Saloon in which she had been riding, its windshield reflecting the blinding glare of the afternoon sun. She could not make out the face of the driver, but she knew he must be watching. Don't let appearances fool you. There's always only one reality. Almama took in a long, deep breath and slowly let it out. Then, to the tune of Billie Jean, she swung her leg over the metal barrier. Her miniskirt rode up to her hips. Who gives a damn? Let them look all they want. Seeing what's under my skirt doesn't let them really see me as a person. Besides, her legs were the part of her body of which Almama was the most proud. Stepping down once she was on the other side of the barrier, Almama straightened her skirt, brushed the dust from her hands, put her coat back on, slung her bag across her chest again, and pushed her sunglasses more snugly against her face. The emergency stairway lay before her, a metal stairway painted gray. Plain, practical, functional. Not made for use by mini-skirted women wearing only stockings on their otherwise bare feet. Nor had Junko Shimada designed Almama's suit for use on the emergency escape stairs of Tokyo Metropolitan Expressway No. 3. Another huge truck roared down the outbound side of the expressway, shaking the stairs. The breeze whistled through gaps in the stairway's metal framework. But in any case, there it was before her, the stairway. All that was left for her to do was climb down to the street. Almama turned for one last look at the double line of cars packed on the expressway, scanning them from left to right, then right to left, like a speaker on a podium looking for questions from the audience now that she had finished her talk. There had been no movement at all. Trapped on the expressway with nothing else to occupy them, people were watching her every move, wondering what this woman on the far side of the barrier would do next. Almama lightly pulled in her chin, bit her lower lip, and took stock of her audience through the dark green lenses of her sunglasses. You couldn't begin to imagine who I am, where I'm going, or what I'm about to do. Amamis said to her audience without moving her lips. All of you are trapped here. You can't go anywhere, forward or back. But I'm not like you. I have work to do. I have a mission to accomplish, and so, with your permission, I shall move ahead. Almame had the urge at the end to treat her assembled throng to one of her special scowls, but she managed to stop herself. There was no time for such things now. Once she let herself frown, it took both time and effort to regain her original expression. Almame turned her back on her silent audience, and with careful steps began to descend the emergency stairway, feeling the chill of the crude metal rungs against the soles of her feet. Also chilling was the early April breeze, which swept her hair back now and then, revealing her misshapen left ear.
Chapter 2. Tengo. Something else in mind. Tengo's first memory dated from the time he was 1 and a half. His mother had taken off her blouse and dropped the shoulder straps of her white slip to let a man who was not his father suck on her breasts. The infant in the crib nearby was probably Tengo himself. He was observing the scene as a third person. Or could the infant have been his twin? No, not likely. It was 1 and a half-year-old Tengo. He knew this intuitively. The infant was asleep, its eyes closed, its little breaths deep and regular. The vivid 10-second scene was seared into the wall of his consciousness, his earliest memory in life. Nothing came before or after it. It stood out alone, like the steeple of a town visited by a flood, thrusting up above the muddy water. Tengo made a point of asking people how old they were at the time of their first memory. For most people it was 4 or 5, 3 at the very earliest. A child had to be at least 3 to begin observing a surrounding scene with a degree of rationality. In the stage before that, everything registered as incomprehensible chaos. The world was a mushy bowl of loose gruel, lacking framework or handholds. It flowed past our open windows without forming memories in the brain. Surely a 1-and-a-half-year-old infant was unable to grasp what it meant for a man who was not his father to be sucking his mother's breasts. That much was clear. So if this memory of Tengo's was genuine, the scene must have been seared into his retinas as a pure image, free of judgment, the way a camera records objects on film, mechanically, as a blend of light and shadow. And as his consciousness matured, the fixed image held in reserve would have been analyzed, bit by bit, and meaning applied to it. But is such a thing even possible? Was the infant brain capable of preserving images like that? Or was this simply a false memory of Tengo's? Was it just something that his mind had later decided, for whatever purpose or plan, to make up on its own? Tengo had given plenty of thought to the possibility that this memory might be a fabrication, but he had arrived at the conclusion that it probably was not. It was too vivid and too deeply compelling to be fake. The light, the smells, the beating of his heart, these felt overwhelmingly real, not like imitations. And besides, it explained many things, both logically and emotionally, to assume that the scene was real. This vivid 10-second image would come to him without warning and without consideration of either time or place. He could be riding on the subway, or writing formulas on the blackboard, or having a meal, or, as now, sitting and talking to someone across a table, and it would envelop him like a soundless tsunami. By the time he noticed, it would be directly in front of him, and his arms and legs would be paralyzed. The flow of time stopped. The air grew thin, and he had trouble breathing. He lost all connection with the people and things around him. The tsunami's liquid wall swallowed him whole. And though it felt to him as if the world were being closed off in darkness, he experienced no loss of awareness. It was just a sense of having been switched to a new track. Parts of his mind were, if anything, sharpened by the change. He felt no terror, but he could not keep his eyes open. His eyelids were clamped shut, Sounds grew distant, and the familiar image was projected onto the screen of his consciousness again and again. Sweat gushed from every part of his body, and the armpits of his undershirt grew damp. He trembled all over, and his heartbeat grew faster and louder. If he was with someone when it happened, Tengo would feign momentary dizziness. It was, in fact, like a dizzy spell. Everything would return to normal in time. He would pull his handkerchief from his pocket and press it to his mouth. Waiting for the dizziness to pass, he would raise a hand to signal to the other person that it was nothing to worry about. Sometimes it would all be over in 30 seconds. At other times, it went on for over a minute. As long as it lasted, the same image would be repeated as if on a tape machine set on automatic. His mother would drop her shoulder straps, and some man would start sucking on her hardened nipples. She would close her eyes and heave a deep sigh. The warm, familiar scent of mother's milk hovered faintly in the air. Smell is an infant's most acute sense. The sense of smell reveals a great deal. Sometimes it reveals everything. The scene was soundless, the air a dense liquid. All he could hear was the soft beating of his own heart. "Look at this," they say. "Look at this and nothing else," they say. "You are here. You can't go anywhere else," they say. The message is played over and over. This attack was a long one. Tengo closed his eyes, covered his mouth with his handkerchief, as always, and gritted his teeth. He had no idea how long it went on. All he could do was guess based on how worn out he felt afterward. He felt physically drained, more fatigued than he had ever felt before. Some time had to go by before he could open his eyes. His mind wanted to wake up, but his muscles and internal organs resisted. He might as well have been a hibernating animal trying to wake up in the wrong season. "Tengo? Tengo!" someone was calling. The muffled voice seemed to reach him from the depths of a cave. It finally dawned on Tengo that he was hearing his own name. "What's wrong, Tengo? Is it happening to you again? Are you all right?" The voice sounded closer now. Tengo finally opened his eyes, managed to focus them, and stared at his own right hand, gripping the edge of the table. Now he could be sure that the world still existed in one piece, and that he was still a part of it. Some numbness remained, but the hand was certainly his. So too was the smell of sweat emanating from him, an oddly harsh odor like a zoo animal's. His throat was dry. Tengo reached for the glass on the table and drank half its contents, carefully trying not to spill any. After a momentary rest to catch his breath, he drank the remainder. His mind was gradually coming back to where it belonged, and his senses were returning to normal. He set the empty glass down and wiped his mouth with his handkerchief. "Sorry," he said. "I'm okay now." He knew that the man across from him was Komatsu, and that they had been talking at a cafe near Tokyo's Shinjuku station. The sounds of other nearby conversations now sounded like normal voices. The couple at the neighboring table were staring at him, obviously concerned. The waitress stood by with a worried expression on her face, as though she expected her customer to vomit. Tengo looked up and nodded to her, smiling, as if to signal, "Don't worry, no problem."
"That wasn't some kind of fit, was it?" Komatsu asked.
"No, it's nothing. A kind of dizzy spell. A bad one," Tengo replied. His voice still didn't sound like his own, though it was getting closer.
"It'd be terrible if that happened while you were driving or something," Komatsu said, looking directly at him.
"I don't drive."
"That's good. I know a guy with a cedar pollen allergy who started sneezing at the wheel and smashed into a telephone pole. Of course, your thing is not just sneezing." "I was shocked the first time. I'm more or less used to it now, though."
"Sorry." Tengo picked up his coffee cup and gulped down what was left. He tasted nothing, just felt some lukewarm liquid passing down his throat.
"Want to order another glass of water?" Komatsu asked.
Tengo shook his head.
"No, I'm okay now."
Komatsu took a pack of Marlboros from his jacket pocket, put one in his mouth, and lit up with the cafe's matches. Then he glanced at his watch.
What were we talking about again? Tengo asked, trying to get back to normal.
Good question, Komatsu said, staring off into space, thinking, or pretending to.
Tengo could not be sure which. There was a good deal of acting involved in the way Komatsu spoke and gestured.
That's it. The girl, Fukairi. We were just getting started on her and Air Chrysalis.
Tengo nodded. That was it. He was just beginning to give his opinion on Fukairi and her novella, Air Chrysalis, when the attack hit him.
Komatsu said, I was going to tell you about that odd one-word pen name of hers.
It is odd, isn't it? The Fuka sounds like part of a family name, and the Eri could be an ordinary girl's name, Eri or Eriko.
That's exactly what it is. Her family name is Fukada, and her real first name is Eriko. So she put them together. Fuka plus Eri equals Fukairi.
Tengo pulled the manuscript from his briefcase and laid it on the table, resting his hand atop the sheaf of paper to reaffirm its presence.
As I mentioned briefly on the phone, the best thing about this Air Chrysalis is that it's not an imitation of anyone. It has absolutely none of the usual new writer's sense of, I want to be another so-and-so. The style, for sure, is rough, and the writing is clumsy. She even gets the title wrong. She's confusing Chrysalis and Cocoon. You could pick it apart completely if you wanted to. But the story itself has real power. It draws you in. The overall plot is a fantasy, but the descriptive detail is incredibly real. The balance between the two is excellent. I don't know if words like originality or inevitability fit here, and I suppose I might agree if someone insisted it's not at that level. But finally, after you work your way through the thing, with all its faults, it leaves a real impression. It gets to you in some strange, inexplicable way that may be a little disturbing.
Komatsu kept his eyes on Tengo, saying nothing. He was waiting to hear more.
Tengo went on. I'd hate to see this thing drop from the competition just because the style is clumsy. I've read tons of submissions over the years, or maybe I should say skimmed rather than read. A few of them were fairly well written, of course, but most of them were just awful. And out of all those manuscripts, this Air Chrysalis is the only one that moved me the least bit. It's the only one that ever made me want to read it again.
Well, well, Komatsu said, and then, as if he found this all rather boring, he released a stream of smoke through his pursed lips.
Tengo had known Komatsu too long to be deceived by such a display, however. Komatsu was a man who often adopted an expression that was either unrelated to or exactly the opposite of what he was actually feeling. And so Tengo was prepared to wait him out.
I read it too, Komatsu said after a short pause.
Right after you called me. The writing is incredibly bad. It's ungrammatical, and in some places you have no idea what she's trying to say. She should go back to school and learn how to write a decent sentence before she starts writing fiction.
But you did read it to the end, didn't you?
Komatsu smiled. It was the kind of smile he might have found way in the back of a normally unopened drawer.
You're right. I did read it all the way through, much to my own surprise. I never read these new writer prize submissions from beginning to end. I even reread some parts of this one. Let's just say the planets were in perfect alignment. I'll grant it that much.
Which means it has something, don't you think?
Komatsu set his cigarette in an ashtray and rubbed the side of his nose with the middle finger of his right hand. He did not, however, answer Tengo's question.
Tengo said, She's just 17, a high school kid. She still doesn't have the discipline to read and write fiction, that's all. It's practically impossible for this work to take the new writer's prize, I know, but it's good enough to put on the short list. You can make that happen, I'm sure. So then she can win next time.
Komatsu said with another non-committal answer and a yawn. He took a drink from his water glass.
Think about it, Tengo. Imagine if I put it on the short list. The members of the selection committee would faint, or more likely have a shit fit. But they would definitely not read it all the way through. All four of them are active writers, busy with their own work.
They'd skim the first couple of pages and toss it out as if it were some grade school composition. I could plead with them to give it another try and guarantee them it would be brilliant with a little polishing here and there. But who's going to listen to me? Even supposing I could make it happen, I'd only want to do that for something with more promise. So you're saying we should drop it just like that? No, that is not what I'm saying, Komatsu said, rubbing the side of his nose. I've got something else in mind for this story.
Something else in mind, Tengo said. He sensed something ominous in Komatsu's tone.
You're saying we should count on her next work as a winner, Komatsu said. I'd like to be able to do that, too, of course.
One of an editor's greatest joys is nurturing a young writer over time. It's a thrill to look at the clear night sky and discover a new star before anybody else sees it. But to tell you the truth, Tengo, I don't believe this girl has a next work in her. Not to boast, but I've been making my living in this business for 20 years now. I've seen writers come and go, and if I've learned anything, it's how to tell the difference between writers who have a next work in them and those who don't. And if you ask me, this girl doesn't have one. Her next work is not going to make it, and neither will the one after that or the one after that. First of all, look at this style. No amount of work is going to make it any better. It's never going to happen. And the reason it's never going to happen is that the writer herself doesn't give a damn about style. She shows absolutely no intention of wanting to write well, of wanting to improve her writing. Good style happens in one of two ways. The writer either has an inborn talent or is willing to work herself to death to get it. And this girl, Fukairi, belongs to neither type. Don't ask me why, but style as such simply doesn't interest her. What she does have, though, is the desire to tell a story, a fairly strong desire. I grant her that. Even in this raw form, it was able to draw you in, Tengo, and it made me read the manuscript all the way through. That alone is impressive, you could say. But she has no future as a novelist. None. I hate to disappoint you, but that's my honest opinion.
Tengo had to admit that Komatsu could be right. The man possessed good editorial instincts, if nothing else.
Still, it wouldn't hurt to give her a chance, would it? Tengo asked.
You mean throw her in, see if she sinks or swims?
In a word.
I've done too much of that already. I don't want to watch anybody else drown.
Well, what about me?
You at least are willing to work hard, Komatsu said cautiously. As far as I can tell, you don't cut corners. You're very modest when it comes to the act of writing.
And why?
Because you like to write. I value that in you. It's the single most important quality for somebody who wants to be a writer.
But not in itself enough.
No, of course, not in itself enough. There also has to be that special something, an indefinable quality, something I can't quite put my finger on. That's the part of fiction I value more highly than anything else. Stuff I understand perfectly doesn't interest me, obviously. It's very simple.
Tengo fell silent for a while. Then he said,
"Does Fukairi's writing have something that you don't understand perfectly?"
"Yes, it does, of course. She has something important. I don't know what it is exactly, but she has it. That much is clear. It's obvious to you, and it's obvious to me. Anybody can see it, like the smoke from a bonfire on a windless afternoon. But whatever she has, Tengo, she probably can't carry it on her own."
"Meaning if we throw her in the water, she'll drown?"
"Exactly."
"And that's why you don't want to put her on the short list."
"That is exactly why."
Komatsu contorted his lips and folded his hands on the table.
"Which brings us to a point in the conversation where I have to be very careful how I express myself."
Tengo picked up his coffee cup and stared at the puddle inside. Then he put the cup down again. Komatsu still had not spoken.
Tengo asked, "Is this where I find out what you mean by something else?"
Komatsu narrowed his eyes like a teacher gazing upon his prize pupil. He nodded slowly and said, "It is." There was something inscrutable about this man, Komatsu. You couldn't easily tell from his expression or tone of voice what he was thinking or feeling. He appeared to derive a good deal of pleasure from keeping others guessing. Mentally, he was very quick, that was for certain. He was the type of man who had his own sense of logic and reached his own conclusions without regard to the opinions of others. He did not engage in pointless intellectual display, but it was clear that he had read an enormous amount and that his knowledge was both wide-ranging and deep. Nor was it simply a matter of factual knowledge. He had an intuitive eye, both for people and for books. His biases played a large role here, but for Komatsu, bias was an important element of truth. He never said a great deal, and he hated long-winded explanations, but when necessary, he could present his views logically and precisely. He could also be quite caustic if he felt like it, aiming a quick and merciless jab at his opponent's weakest point. He had very strong opinions about both people and literature. The works and individuals he could not tolerate far outnumbered those he could. Not surprisingly, the number of people who disliked him was far greater than those who thought well of him, which was exactly what he hoped for. Tengo thought that Komatsu enjoyed the isolation and even relished being openly hated. Komatsu believed that mental acuity was never born from comfortable circumstances. At 45, Komatsu was 16 years older than Tengo. A dedicated editor of literary magazines, he had established a certain reputation as one of the top people in the industry, but no one knew a thing about his private life. He met with people constantly in his work, but he never spoke of anything personal. Tengo had no idea where he was born or raised, or even where he lived. They often had long conversations, but such topics never came up. People were puzzled that a difficult man like Komatsu was able to solicit manuscripts from writers. He had no friends to speak of, and displayed only contempt for the literary world. But over the years, he managed, almost effortlessly, to obtain work by famous authors for the magazine, and more than a few issues owed their contents to his efforts. So even if they didn't like him, people respected him. Rumor had it that when Komatsu was a student in the prestigious University of Tokyo's Department of Literature in 1960, he had been one of the leaders of the huge leftist demonstrations against the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. He was said to have been near fellow student Michiko Kanba when she was killed by riot police, and to have suffered serious injuries himself. No one knew if this was true, but there was something about Komatsu that made the stories seem convincing. He was tall and gangly, with an oversized mouth and an undersized nose. He had long limbs and nicotine-stained fingers, reminiscent of those failed revolutionary intellectuals in 19th-century Russian novels. He rarely smiled, but when he did, it was with his whole face. Not that it made him look especially happy. He was more like an old sorcerer chuckling to himself over an ominous prophecy he was about to reveal. Clean and decently groomed, he always wore a tweed jacket, white Oxford cloth or pale gray polo shirt, no tie, gray pants, suede shoes. A uniform meant to show the world he didn't care about these things. Tengo imagined a half dozen three-button tweed jackets of a subtly different color, cloth, and pattern that hung, carefully brushed, in Komatsu's closet. Perhaps Komatsu had to attach number tags to distinguish one jacket from another. Komatsu's fine, wiry hair was beginning to show a touch of gray in front. Tangled on the sides, it was long enough to cover his ears, and it always stayed that length, about a week overdue for a haircut. Tengo wondered how such a thing was possible. At times, Komatsu's eyes would take on a sharp glow, like stars glittering in the winter night sky. And if something caused him to clam up, he would maintain his silence like a rock on the far side of the moon. All expression would disappear from his face, and his body seemed to go cold. Tengo first met Komatsu 5 years earlier when he was shortlisted for the New Writers' Prize competition of Komatsu's magazine. Komatsu called and said he wanted to get together for a chat. They agreed to meet in a cafe in Shinjuku, the same one in which they were now sitting. Komatsu told Tengo there was no way his work would take the prize, and in fact it did not. Komatsu himself, however, had enjoyed the story. I'm not looking for thanks, but I almost never say this to anyone, he said. This was in fact true, as Tengo came to learn. So I'd like you to let me read your next story before you show it to anyone else. Tengo promised to do that. Komatsu also